So what I'd like to do is call this meeting to order for the San Leandro City Council Facilities and Transportation Committee. Right now it's 4:03. I'd appreciate it if our committee clerk would take attendance.
Councilmember Acevedo. He said president. Councilmember Bowe.
Present.
Mayor Gonzalez.
Present. Your announcement, please.
After each agenda item is presented, the mayor will ask for committee member comments and then take public comments. You will have 2 minutes to share your comments. If you would like to comment, if you could please fill out a speaker card. Thank you.
So at each of these gatherings, we have the opportunity for the public to comment on items that are not on our agenda. So if anybody would like to speak on an item, a topic that is not related to the Mulford Branch or Casa Peralta, this would be the time. Do we have any speaker cards?
No speaker cards.
Seeing no speaker cards, we'll close that item two, and move to item three, discussion. First, we will cover Casa Peralta, and for this item, I will need to excuse myself, so I will recuse myself, and then when that item is complete, I will receive a text message. I will come back. For our second item, Councilmember Bolt will need to recuse himself, and so we will do a little switcheroo, and we will continue with our presentations. I do have one question before beginning. The public has all of this information in hard copy. So if you don't have this information yet, please realize that we do have hard copies available for you. And thank you for joining us. I feel like this is a college class where we went out. It's May and everyone's saying, can we have class outside? And so we managed to do that. So with that happy thought, I will recuse myself. And I'm passing the chair to Councilmember Acevedo.
Hello, everyone. Welcome. Can you hear me? Can you hear me? Okay. Welcome, everyone. Okay, let's go to discussion item 3A, Casa Peralta update. Library Director Brian Simons will introduce the item.
I don't have that anymore. 3A? Oh, okay. Sorry. You guys have
it. Oh, okay. All right, thank you very much, committee members. On page two, we're starting on page two. So why are we here this evening discussing this matter? So the CASA is currently not in the best shape. It's in a state of disrepair, and we're looking for council action for future direction. And our intent this evening is to provide context necessary to inform you and also to inform your discussion and also a decision. Next page. Page three. So let's take a step back before we get moving forward, which would be, you know, why is this significant in the first place? So the Peralta family significance, so real top level. I know there's a lot of people from Historical Society here tonight, which can go very deep into this, but very top level. Really, two families were granted land in San Leandro. And at that time, it wasn't even San Leandro. It was to become San Leandro. And one of the families was the Peraltas, and they were granted land by the Crown of Spain, ranging from San Leandro Creek north all the way to El Cerrito, and then the Estudillos, which were granted land from the creek south to San Lorenzo Creek. And 81 years later, in 1901, the descendants of the Peraltas built Casa Peralta. And interestingly enough, though, it was on the Estudillo side of the creek. So it's not on ancestral Peralta land. It's on the other side. Just going to the next page. So what is Casa Peralta? While it is a large historic home, it really ostensibly still is. It's a four-bedroom home. Once had two baths on the second floor. And it has a dining room, a kitchen, and also four living areas, one of which on the second floor. So it is two floors. There's a semi-connected tower. So we're sitting adjacent to the tower now, and it's semi-connected because there's kind of this little bridge piece. And I don't know what the architectural people can help me, but the gangway, I would call it, If you go over that, that's the house side over there. And in the tower, really what that, you know, functionally was a one bedroom, one bath apartment. And then we all, as we can see, we came in through the walled gates. It sits on grounds which are about 32,550 square feet. And the grounds are walled in this beautiful sanctuary space. And there are two non-functioning fountains on the property as well. So the next page, page 5, the Casa Peralta history. So like I said, it was constructed in 1901 in a colonial revival style. It was renovated in 1927 into the style we see it now, which is Spanish revival style. In 1938, the Peraltas sold the property. And from 38 to 1969, it operated as a rest home or a sanitarium for alcoholism. And then in 1969, the Brooks family purchased it because it was in danger of being torn down for development. And then in 1971, the Brooks family donated it to the city. So going on to the next page. So the gift grant deed, which we'll get into in the next slide, currently we're on slide 6. So the gift grant deed, it does have some limiting factors of what can be done with it. So under the city's ownership, we can only do certain things, and mainly cultural, historical purposes. So from 1971 to 2006, the house itself acted as the history museum. And right now we have the history museum to the counter, the committee's left. Prior to that, we didn't, so it acted as that. There were school and docent tours, and the Casa grounds were also used. In the 90s, there were some concerns about the safety of the building, in part because there was an earthquake in 89, and it led to some restricted use going forward. In 2006, the History Museum was built, so then the Casa Peralta became a little bit more of an ancillary piece to the tours, in part because of the restrictions, the safety restrictions as well. But there still were school and docent tours being done, and it kind of started to operate as more of a historical park with the grounds. In 2015 to the present, SLIA has leased the tower and acts as caretakers of the space. And in 2016, docent tours ended, school tours and the grounds use became a little more limited because there started to become some seismic and other safety concerns, as well as some liability concerns with docents being unaccompanied by city staff. That's not something we would do any longer. And then in 2020, we ceased tours entirely, partly due to the pandemic, but also because of growing safety concerns. That said, there is still limited use of the Casa grounds, which we're doing today. Page 7. So the gift grant deed from 1971, this is what gave us the legal document that gave us the property from the Brooks. It has really like 6 stipulations in it. The first one I talked about already was there's some limiting factors. That's number one. The underlined ones you see here are really the ones that I want to focus on. Are the number two is the city shall maintain it in a manner suitable for the above stated purpose, which is to use it as a community, cultural, recreational, and historical center. It at least as good of condition as presently existed when it was donated in 71. We've struggled to do that. And then the third bullet, if the city cannot reconstruct it to its present condition in the event of damage or destruction by natural causes, so earthquake, fire, flood, etc., the city will retain, maintain, and operate it as a park. There's maybe some precedent there that if things were to need to happen. For sure, this speaks to, you know, an act of God kind of disaster. But, you know, we've had it for 54 years. And if it is in a place where it really cannot be reconstructed, maybe this is an avenue as well to consider. And then the next two are a little lighter. It's saying it should be used for priority for youth and senior groups. And then number 5, is there shouldn't be any commercial or business purpose other than to maybe charge fees to use the space to then be used to maintain the CASA itself. But number six is really the big one. If the property is not used in accordance with these conditions, the estate shall revert back to the grantors and their heirs or assigns. So those six stipulations are pretty important as you guys consider what the next steps might be. So going on to the next page, page eight. So some of the other context to take into consideration is in 1982, it became part of the National Register of Historic Places and also on the State Historic Resources Inventory. So normally, if this was a residential home, there would be more restrictions put on the property than what exists for the city, in part because the property tax reduction doesn't exist. The Mills Act doesn't exist for the city. As well as, I mean, it exists for residents, but not for city ownership. And there's no state or federal funding that we receive for the CASA. So a lot of the restrictions that might apply don't apply. Now the limitations that do exist are if there are changes done to the property, they are subject to the California Environmental Quality Act, known as CEQA. So it's subject to the review. And then also the state historic building code must be considered by the chief building official. So really what this means though is the city is not outright prevented from taking action on the site. Unlike maybe other properties, there might be a few more restrictions. But if it were to make some kind of action or change, it very much just needs to follow the appropriate approval process dependent on whatever that action might be. So going on to the next page. Other contexts to take into consideration on page nine is there are groups connected to the property. So there's the Little Brown Church in the back corner that's owned by the Historical Society, but on the land that is the city's, which is within these walls. The property, as we see here, abuts the San Leandro History Museum. The San Leandro Improvement Association, SLIA, is a tenant of the property. And the Dahlia Society, right behind us here, uses the grounds as their growing beds for their flowers. So we also just want to call to the attention and recognize that, you know, emotions are attached to this property as they would be for any historic property or any history. So that is something to be sensitive to and take into consideration. On the next page, on page 10, funding and maintenance struggles. So in 1985, The City of San Leandro enacted the City of San Leandro Casa Peralta Policy Statement. So what is that statement? What it is is it outlines who's responsible for oversight and maintenance. It lists community groups, some of which were on that previous slide, who have an interest in the property, how donations are to be handled, and also that, just to call this out, is that the reason for that policy generation was because the city wasn't maintaining the house, and the Brooks family wanted to see some action done to try to ensure that the city would take better care of it. In 89, there was earthquake damage. So there was, in 95, there was a seismic evaluation done by EQE International as consultants. From that evaluation, in 95 and 96, repairs were done to the building codes of that time, mainly to prevent collapse, not to worry about damage, but just collapse. And then in 2016, things, as I said, previous slide, you know, things were still progressing. We were having some more safety concerns, codes change, et cetera. In 2016, there was a needs assessment report done by Architectural Resources Group, known as ARG. And then from that report in 2015, through 2019, there were $3.6 million allocated to the property. However, in 2021, $2.1 million of those funds were redirected to other CIP projects. So the point of this slide is to show, with all good intentions, we've always wanted to do something with this facility and upgrade it, but the city has really struggled to prioritize it. Next slide, slide 11. I'm going to turn this one over to our chief building official, Mike Jeffrey.
How are you? Thank you. I'm Mike Jeffrey, the chief building official here. I'll preface, I was going to say this after my two slides, but I do have memories of this place. Born and raised here, walking here with my grandma, going to church at St. Leander's. So I do have an emotional attachment to this place. So, that said, sorry. Back up a little bit. I do have an attachment to this place, a lot of fond memories. but I'm here regarding the building condition as it sits right now. And if you're all looking at page 11, I have a few examples here. One of the main things here, if we start from the bottom up, is the foundation. 90% of this building is brick. You can kind of, at the top right is an example of settling. And what I did notice, I crawled this building twice, about a year ago, and then just about 2 weeks ago. And in that time, it's worsened a bit. It gains speed. Deterioration gains speed. It's exponential. And I've noticed a lot of difference in actually less than a year. But what they did was, at some point in time, they plastered the brick and made it look really good. It almost looked like a concrete foundation. But at the same time, as it settles, and you can tell by those levels on the second floor, 4 feet distance here, almost 2 inches of settling around the perimeter. So that said, what happens is the brick settles and the plaster kind of pings off, exposing the brick. So at a glance, if the plaster didn't fall off, from a distance, it looks like concrete, but it's indeed unreinforced masonry. I crawled the whole perimeter last week, and it's definitely 90% brick sitting on, and I'll talk about it in a moment, but this whole area, basically from 580 West, is liquefaction prone. So, back in 1901, there was no soils investigation. They just, built. So who knows? We don't even know the depth of the foundation. Again, it's unreinforced. There was some work done in the 90s to kind of keep the building, as Director Simons mentioned, from collapsing. But at the same time, the building is only as good as the foundation is. And this foundation is not good. That said, there was that review done back in 2016 for $6 or $7 million. I'm not going to talk about the money, but there's a lot of other considerations, i.e. liquefaction. It has to be designed to where it could support this big building. And in building terms, this is considered a heavy, meaning stucco construction, a lot of masonry. So it has a lot of forces on it, especially during an earthquake. But that said, with the settling and rebuild, we'd have to start with the foundation. Now, we have a little bit of latitude with the California Historic Building Code and the California Existing Building Code, but it still has to meet a code. So an engineer can come back to us and try to make that brick foundation work with some improvements, but in the past, that hasn't worked. It's always been more expensive to do that than to, stabilize the building and pour a new foundation. Part of my history, too, being born and raised here, I was a contractor here for 25 years and worked on homes early 1900s, Craftsman Homes and so on, and Tudors. And I tell you, every time we get into these places, there's 30 or 40% change orders increase in the value. I always warn my customers up front that expect change orders because you don't know what you're going to see when you pull that stucco off. And I can tell you, when you see the rot at the top of the building, that's kind of, that's what I wrote here, iceberg effect, the tip of the iceberg. What happens is water rolls downhill, obviously, but then it builds up. It does not drain. And it just builds up on the wood framing. It kind of marinates the wood through the years and rots it. So from 25 years of experience of working on old homes, restoring, doubling their size, that when you open this up, you're going to find, a lot of damage. So, and that's an unknown. So that stops the job. There has to be change orders, decisions made. An unknown. And when you open it up, that's what the cost overruns. So always keep 30, 40% in mind if this were to go on in change orders. Then there's other considerations since it is a historic house. Well, first of all, we have to go through and abate mold, asbestos, before any work is done. And Restoration and replication is very tedious. It takes a specific skill set, and it's not just going in here and demoing and rebuilding. If you want to match, I know you guys, a lot of you all are in historical society. If you want to match it or get as close as possible, it takes a lot of money to get to that point too. So that's another consideration. You might wonder what all the yellow tape is, but when I re-walked this place and crawled it last week, there's just too many things falling off the building that and railings are rotted out. So that said, I wanted to yellow tag it just to keep people off the structure itself. Next page. And you can see the settling on those photos. So the condition itself, if I were to rate it from a 1 to 10, 10 being good, I would say it's about a 4. And then the look affection, guest house floor framing were not observable. You all could read this. The guest house, or this structure here, the tower, seems to be in better shape. I think it was built a little bit later. But there's a lot of things to consider. We would request the geotechnical report before any kind of foundation work is either designed or even thought of. Let's see, but I think that's about it. The photos, you can tell, just replicating these windows and the railings that are all deteriorated and failing fast is, you know, quite expensive. But as the building official, I think I'm best suited simply because living here, have an attachment to this place, I would be an advocate, but I'm also a realist. So at the end of the day, my opinion is this will cost a lot of money and more than just a face value estimate.
Okay. Speaking of costs, good afternoon. My name is Sheila Marquises, Public Works Director. So we're on slide 13. As Mike mentioned, or referred to the 2016 assessment to restore Casa Peralta, the estimate was about $5.7 million. So again, those were 2016 numbers. So the chart below that is various indices, escalation factors, that throughout the years, if we were to look at the very last column about 2027, assuming we would be in construction in that year, it would be pretty close to $10 million. That would be the cost to restore at Casa Peralta. But we also want to note that that is just construction costs. So we have to consider soft costs, which we usually refer to the staff costs to design and manage that project. So we expect that that could be another $5 million. And so looking at next slide, so slide 14, so budget considerations. Director Summons referred to the initial allocation for Casa Peralta. There is still a remaining $1.4 million, and that was intended for basic repairs for the walkway, the roof, painting, exterior wall repairs. So that's about $1.4 million. We're in the middle of budget discussions, and it was at a recent Finance Committee meeting. Staff was directed to consider past projects and whether or not the $1.4 million is still an appropriate use of general funds. This is why we're here to talk about it today. So with that, I'm going to pass it back to Director Simon.
Thank you. Thank you both. So where are we? Oops, hopefully my paper won't blow away on me. So we've got a few options to consider. One is renovate it. That would be, you know, the most expensive option of the three that we've found. That'd be that $10 to $15 million, you know, more than what is in the budget currently. Optimistically, though, maybe there's a donor. Who knows? Maybe a donor is out there. Maintaining it, though, even when we build it, would cost approximately another $112,000 annually. So that, again, is money not currently in the budget that we would have to think about how that would come about. And there are some opportunity costs. And what I mean by that is this is going to be a multi-year project. If that's what the direction the council would want us to go, that's fine. It does take away from especially the public works engineering folks working on other capital improvement projects as well. Another potential option is adaptive reuse. So just as one example of what that might look like, is this property becomes a historical Dahlia Botanical Garden Park. In the Parks Master Plan, which was recently unveiled, there is a call for more green space in downtown. The ability to preserve what we can and repurpose of the facility would be looked at as well. And in addition to that, we would do the CEQA required preservation activities, but also do like a documentary with the house still existing and a virtual reality experience we could house in the museum as another way to do preservation. This would be the second more expensive option, but there $3 million might already exist from the Park and Lou funds to make that happen. The gift grant deed would be something we'd need to look at. Again, as I alluded earlier in the presentation, we might already have cause in there because it does spell out it could be used as a park. If not, if it is something we'd want to renegotiate with the existing family, that they would either need to amend or rescind the gift grant deed. The National Register and the State Register would be something we want to work through. On the upside, though, this does have the potential, probably the most potential, for an economic benefit to the city, because there's more ability to rent the grounds out, as an example, for uses by the public. Weddings, quinceañeras, first communions, that kind of thing. And then the third option would be relinquish ownership. There is that provision within the gift grant deed to gift it back. If the family were not to want it gifted back, we'd work with them to either amend or rescind the gift grant deed, which would open the door for that other use of number two or some other use in general, or moving it on to some other organization as well. And then the annual maintenance costs would be eliminated. So that would bring in not only the $1.4 million of capital improvement back into the budget as a potential, but also what's spent on it annually for maintenance. With that, that concludes our presentation. What we're looking for from the committee is some direction of which of these options looks most appealing that you would want us to explore more.
Okay, we'll move to committee questions and clarifications. My first question is, have we reached out to the Brooks family at this point and talked to them about anything they're considering or want to see?
I have not. I have heard through the grapevine, so I don't know how true this all is, a few years ago had told me they had spoken with them, and it's so many years ago I don't remember anymore who it was. But they had mentioned at that time they were not interested in owning the property. However, times change. If that is a direction we would want to go, we would need to re-engage the Brooks family in a conversation.
Okay, thank you. When you're talking about turning it into a park and using it for quinceañeras and weddings and stuff like that, are you saying tear the building down and turn this thing into a park?
That's one potential option, yes.
Okay, I'll start. Okay. You asked some of the questions I was going to ask. Okay, so one of the questions, thank you all for your presentation. I do have an attachment to this too, also. I've been going here since I was a kid. I'm a fourth generation in San Andreas, so I've been coming here for a long time. Okay, so we said it would cost. Cost $10 million to fix it, basically. And then you mentioned another $5 million for staff to design it.
Correct. Those are the soft costs, the project management, inspection, design, permits.
Yeah. Okay, so it could cost up to a total of $15 million.
Correct.
Okay, my other question is about turning it into a park. What are the options for that? That was kind of a question I was wondering. For a park, are we going to put different stuff for kids or what?
I think to your question, that would be what we would, our next steps would be looking into, if that's a direction you would like us to explore. Because I think there's a lot of potential options. So I think that's really, we haven't gone to that level because each one of these options is an effort into in and of itself.
Yes.
Thank you, Council Member. Good evening. Good afternoon, committee, community members. I wanted to say on that point, to this evening, we're just looking for the committee to provide any kind. So if a park, for example, was something you're like, let's explore, that does not mean today you're saying you want to turn it into a park. There just could be more answers, questions that you want answers to related to that. And if the staff, for example, if the staff came back with some more answers, and at that point you're like, absolutely yes, absolutely no, those could be answered later today. It's just the first discussion on this item, and you could send us with more work to do to come back with some more answers or direction overall.
Okay, thank you for that. Yeah, so I would really like to see what the community would like to do with this place, because it's really up to them. It's not all about me, it's about this place. So let's go to the next item, public comment. Do we have people that would like to speak?
Oh, I have.
There you go.
Can I have Evelyn Gonzalez, Donald Pollard, Linda Pollard, and Cindy Simmons stand up?
Where do you want us to speak from?
Just stand right here.
Okay.
Okay, dear council members, city manager, staff, my name is Evelyn Gonzalez, and I am the president of the San Leandro Historical Society. This historical society is very concerned about the state of the CASA, and in 2023, we approached the city to partner with the city on a CASA capital campaign. The issues we encountered was that grants, major donors, etc., all wanted updated costs, and the last costs were the 2016 study that was done. We reached out to the construction company, to a construction management company, as well as the company ARG that did the 2016 study. And both experts felt that the city's projected costs were too high. Without an on-site inspection, though, they couldn't give us any accurate cost for what it would be. In the summer of 2024, the Historical Society Board voted to fund an updated study. As we were scheduling a date for these experts, we were told by the city that it wanted to bring the CASA to this committee first, before we did any sort of continued assessment on it. For 10 years, I served on the School District Facilities Committee. In that time, we approved over a quarter of a billion dollars in building projects, including renovations of 100-year-old buildings. Experts that work with these older buildings know what to expect, and good companies give you accurate costs. I request that the committee allow the Historical Society to gather the information on accurate costs for the renovations before making a decision regarding the CASA. Thank you.
I'm not long-winded, so I'll keep it short. The Casa Peralta is history. We don't get enough history. This is in the heart of the city. Our kids would, and our grandkids would love to know more history. So I just think it's an asset for the city.
Hi, I'm Linda Pollard, and I'm the secretary of the Historical Society. And I, too, was raised in the city. And I just love the Casa Peralta, and I remember all the things that were available to us. And on behalf of the Historical Society, I do agree in preserving the building and keeping it located at this site.
Hello, my name is Cindy Simmons. I am a board member of the San Leandro Historical Society, and many years ago, I used to work for the city of San Leandro. I was the local history person. I had the pleasure of setting up the first permanent exhibits in the museum. I was the Casa Peralta docent trainer, and so, of course, this place is near and dear to me. But I want to stress what Evelyn just said. We can't know what we can do unless we are allowed in to get some accurate assessments. So please let us do that. And I also just want to say briefly, this building is not just a beautiful building designed by a master architect. but it is a building that takes us back to 1776, when the very first migration of Mexican families came to Mexican Spanish California then to live in this, what is now the state of California. It is a unique example of the transition that the Mexican families made when the U.S. acquired California and gold was discovered at almost exactly the same time, causing one of the biggest migrations in the world. So those Mexican ranches became cities and towns of the East Bay almost overnight. And if we lose this tangible connection to that history, we lose a lot. So please give us a chance to find out if the Historical Society can help you maintain, fix, and use the Casa Peralta and restore it so that it can be used for weddings and quinceañeras as it is in a new and renovated state. Thank you.
That's all the comments.
Okay, committee comments, additional questions, direction to staff.
I have a question. I don't know if it would be to legal, but the $1.4 million, can we use that to get the estimate?
Thank you, Councilmember Bolt. So, as I understand it, the $1.4 million is currently in a CIP account for the Casa Peralta. And typically, monies in CIP accounts would be used for assessments.
I would, then I'll just make the motion that we use part of that $1.4 million to find out what we want to find out, to find, you know, let's understand the true cost. I think it is really hard for us to make a decision here without true information. And so if we understood that it's going to cost $15 million, I'm not saying we wouldn't do it, but that helps us form an opinion. But if we come back and it's $5 million or $8 million, not throwing you under the bus, Mike, and saying your facts are wrong, you know, not in any way. I think we need to have true line items to read and understand. And so I would make a motion to use that money to find out the necessary information we need in the form of an estimate to renovate this site.
Yeah, I would have to agree with that. That yeah, let's get the estimate and see how much it's gonna, the true cost is, and let's go there, because I want to preserve this place. I want to preserve this place if we can. That's important. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I want to preserve this place. This place is important to me. Yeah. So let's see how much the true cost is, like what you guys are talking about, and yeah, let's go from there. So, do you need any more directions? Oh, and I second the motion. Oh, I don't know. Okay, so yeah, we have two votes.
So it's a UCF for renovation, full cost renovation.
So we'll move on to 3A, or I'm going to text the mayor. Does a council member have to recuse himself?
I must recuse myself for the next item, begrudgingly.
Okay, we'll wait a minute so we have a quorum. Okay, yeah, we'll take a quick break and come back.
Item 3B, we've got a Mulford branch update, and we've got Public Works Director Sheila Marquises presenting.
Thank you, Mayor. Good afternoon. Sheila Marquises, Public Works Director. Committee members, we're presenting to you a project update for the Mulford Marina Branch Library. The last committee update was last year in March 6, 2024. The Public Works Engineering Division has been busy designing a new branch library in collaboration with our client, the library department. Shortly, I'm going to pass the mic on to our project manager, Mark Baralka, who will share with you the construction bids received for this project.
Thank you. Thank you, Mayor Gonzalez, committee members, committee staff, and members of the public for being here today. I appreciate the chance to make a presentation on our Mulford Marina Branch Library project. Just real briefly in the handout, I'll go over our recent bid results, the additive alternates that were in the bid, the contract requirements for local businesses, as well as the project cost, budget, and contingency. On the second page, we went out to bid on April 10th, and we had an excellent response. We got 10 bids, which is better than typical. The low bid was a giant construction at $6.8 million. It was lower than the engineer's estimate of $7.1 million. If we're unlikely to get better costs if we were to rebid this project. There were additive alternates were included in the bid to make sure we had a successful process and allowances to award the project different options. There were four additive alternates in the bid. We decided to award alternatives 2 and 4 for the monument sign lighting and city sidewalk along the frontage. Two bid items were not awarded. The decorative ceiling in the children's library and the exterior shade trellis for the multi-purpose room. These are both items that were desired by the library. However, they realized that cost was a factor and decided that it was not worth to proceed at this time with those. Quickly, in regard to local business and hires in the contract, None of the 10 bidders were a local San Leandro business. However, the lowest bidder submitted a good faith effort to meet the requirements. In terms of the community workforce agreement, they submitted all the paperwork to comply with the local hires and community outreach for contract work. Page 6, I'll go over the project costs. The base bid, including additive alternates 2 and 4, came in at around $7 million. There were other project costs of about $2.4 million. Those included the design fees, which is about $1.2 million, permitting of $100,000, fixtures, furnishings, and equipment of $200,000. There's also a contingency of $600,000, which is about 8.5% of the construction cost. Assuming these numbers, it comes in budget at $10 million for the project. If we were to proceed an award and keep the project schedule, we believe it would be prudent to request an additional $630,000, primarily for additional contingency to increase it from 8.5% to 15%, which is $450,000. As well as an allowance for an on-site architect if needed during construction for $175,000. Next slide is the project budget. The general fund is about $5 million. We have a library grant of $4 million, and then a library foundation donation of $800,000. And the total project cost is $10 million currently budgeted. As we discussed earlier on page 6, the project is within budget, assuming a 8.5% contingency and no on-site architect. Additional funding is requested to increase the contingency and provide additional staff as needed based on field progress of the project. Why are we asking for additional contingency? The purpose is to address unexpected site conditions and requirements in a timely manner, especially with the project having a grant deadline as stringent as we have with this library project. Additional funding, if needed, would require council approval, which is a lengthy process and could delay response to urgent construction needs. And delayed responses could lead to extra work and extra costs on the project. See the next slide, slide 14. Another major factor for the request for contingency is the construction timeline and for the grant. It's very, very. It's very challenging to meet that deadline, and to meet this schedule, we needed to accelerate the project and bid when we did, and this required deferring some items that we would prefer to leave to the later to include in the bid documents. The major ones are PG&E and East Bay Mud service applications, as well as mitigations required by the Shoreline Development EIR with our planning department, as well as building permit plan check requirements. We have started all of these items, but we haven't finished them. So any requirements now would be additional changes to the bid documents, which would require extra cost. And here, here to present the staff recommendation is Sheila Marquises. I'll stand by to answer any questions regarding the cost or design of the project. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark. So committee members, for staff recommendations, I want to note this presentation was prepared for you about 2 weeks ago in order to publish in time. Now, budget discussions and developments have been evolving since publishing this agenda and presentation. Under normal circumstances, with an approved budget, we would move forward with a staff recommendation to proceed to city council, to a city council meeting. However, we would like to offer a more thorough conversation with you and the full city council to discuss the true cost and ownership of this new facility. Construction of this new branch is a long-term commitment and has budget impacts for decades for the Public Works Department. There are also budget impacts for to our client, which is the Library Department, to operate the facility. So I'm going to pass the mic over to Library Director Simons.
Thank you. Yes, we would concur with Director Marquises' evaluation that it's something to consider. If we were to build it under the direction that we've been given from Finance Committee, it's maybe worth considering not moving forward with the project, because not only is it current, the CIP funds that would be required to be spent on building it, there's a couple operational concerns that we have. One is long-term, as Director Marquises pointed out, and even short-term, with the current adjustments we've needed to make the direction of the Finance Committee, we'd be looking at closing the current facilities, Main and Manor, on some days. So in order to keep this facility open, we'd still only be able to open it, even if built, under the budget that, even the current budget that we have now, only 12 hours a week. So that is a consideration if we're going to spend all this money to build it and not to be able to open it in a robust, fulsome way for what looks like years to come. That is something that maybe we should the council should consider, is how we're approaching it. Thank you.
That sounds like the end of the presentation.
Yeah.
Okay. So what we're going to do is we're going to ask a few clarifying questions, and we'll go to public comment, and then we'll come back for some discussion.
Yeah, I would like to bring this back to the council on June 2nd. Is anything going to change from now to June 2nd that will impact this?
There is nothing for the project-wise that we expect. If we return to the City Council within 90 days, which is typically when the bids are we usually have to award within 90 days. So we intend to come back to Council
the next opportunity with the agenda.
So those bids are recent. So is there any clause mm-hmm. about tariffs or anything in there, or that it could change, or is it just?
Technically, the tariffs are it's on the contractor.
It's in the contract.
Okay. To take that risk.
Okay.
But that's one of the reasons why we also asked for a higher contingency.
Okay, that's all my questions.
So for the site plan, do we have concerns with respect to, let's say, soils? Have we done soil testing?
Yes, they had a geotechnical report prepared for the site.
I'm talking about contamination.
And there were no concerns, no.
No concerns about contamination.
They did have some contingencies. We could lime treat or treat the soil. It's a 4,000 square foot. It's a tall building, but it's still a single story. And it's a mat slab, a concrete slab. No huge changes expected. Maybe some minor changes to reinforce the soil if we find anything. But it shouldn't be a huge change.
Okay, because I'm starting from a premise that there are no changes. People have had a chance to analyze the soil. The soil is not going to change. So we know what we're building on. The builders know what they're building on.
Right, when they excavate it and, when you open up the soil and they do tests on the soil, they do their best with the borings, their individual spots. But when you open it up and demo the site and grade it, there's always a chance one site might be one area might be different than another.
Okay.
But there are provisions in there. If we hit a soft spot like on a street, we can do a dig out, we can reinforce it, there are known ways to address the uncertainties that we expect.
Because I would assume that within the scope of building a building, that's kind of like rounding error.
I don't know if it would be that small, but it shouldn't be a huge amount.
Okay, because I get very nervous with every time that somebody can describe something as, oh, we didn't know this was the case. Well, there's a lot that you don't know, right?
Right.
So I want to make sure that we go in, assuming that we decide to go forward at council, that we go in with this mentality of, we got to be able to bear some uncertainty in building, because some things will be cheaper than expected. Oh, that turned out to be faster than we thought. And I don't want it always to be one-sided uncertainty. I know that's comment beyond question. So let's go back to the questions. As we think about our design, is there any, are our drawings complete? We have a building that somebody can build. Or are we still designing it?
They don't have the second round of plan check comments. We got the first round of plan check comments. So it's buildable, and maybe just before we move on about the soil foundation, things like if the soil is unstable, we can lime treat the soil, and there's a known cost to that. It's a known treatment that should address that issue. But something like an underground leaking fuel storage tank that no one knew was there is something no one would ever know, and that could be a cost for that. And that's something that we wouldn't know.
I think that's a great example, but if it's just, hey, I need to add some more lime, that's part of your job. Job was to build a building.
Right.
This is not outside the realm of normal variations.
Right.
Okay, so going back to we have drawings, mm-hmm. and there's going to be some plan checks. So help me understand the uncertainty generated by that.
Well, for instance, we're dealing with PG&E right now. The original design had a pad-mounted transformer, and we bid, trying to meet the schedule. Pad-mounted transformer. It's actually in the flood zone. You can't have a transformer in the floodplain. We would need to lift it to the floor plane elevation. And then also speaking with PG&E, based on our load, they don't allow a pad mounted transformer. It has to be a pole mounted transformer. And we have to go with 208 volt versus 240 volt, which affected some of the HVAC units. And it's not a big change, but we had to change instead of one large unit to three smaller ones. And things
so
like that.
They can literally tell us what we can build on our property?
They can refuse service for a...
Well, they'll provide... they're with a, with what a, kind the transformer? Of service, yes. Yeah, well, based on the load, they said it needed to be a certain 70... I'm not sure the exact... 75 kVA, which is a larger load, a commercial load. Our load is almost... On that building, it's almost like a residential load.
Because we're so energy efficient.
Yeah. in that area of town, there's no underground lines. It's older lines. It's there's a lot of overhead power lines.
Yep.
In that area too. So that's one that issue we're dealing with right now. But that's not, you know, we haven't finalized our PG&E permit yet. So that's a change that's not in the bid documents right now. So that's not a huge change, but it will be a change.
So it'll be a pole mounted transformer.
Yes.
So that part will be cheaper because we don't have to build an elevated pad.
Yes.
So that will be a cost offset to whatever we design to make it.
Could be.
It should be. Okay. I think it's time to go to... Do you have any more questions? Let's go to public comment on this item. No public comment?
No.
I just want to confirm.
No public comment.
That's awesome. Okay, let's continue. In terms of operating costs, so I know that one of the concerns appears to be, well, hey, right now we have a budget. We operate that library 12 hours a week. I think one of the intended purposes of the visions had been that we are able to have field trips there so the kids go see the monarch butterflies and all that kind of thing. Are there other ways to, have we thought about other ways to co-use the space with a nonprofit that's based out of the space, for example?
So we haven't gone down that avenue in full depth, but being a library, it would be a challenge, the way it's designed, to co-use that space, because you would need city staff there to ensure items don't walk out the door. It's a big open space, so even the office only seats two people very tightly for the library, and then there's two study rooms. So there's no, if we're thinking of sharing it with like a SLEA or something where they would have an office there, there's no designed space or space for that additional nonprofit office. And then just to have it open in general, we would still need city staff there, which is where the costs really come in. That additional cost comes in with staffing.
And then when we think about alternative uses, renting the space, because it's got, I would call it study spaces, but it could be, you know, phone room spaces. We've got that meeting space. Is it space that we would consider renting?
So right now we would use it just like we do at our other libraries, where the public could use it during open public library hours. The reason we don't go beyond that, again, is staffing. We don't have the staff to oversee it, supervise it, set it up. And with the way the city council has directed the library, the current policy is that we really don't get any revenue when we say renting, other than if it's Saturdays. Because that's, the city council wanted free space for the community to use. The rec space is the space that is for fee all the time, and library is the space that is free on weekdays.
And are you capacity constrained right now on meeting rooms during the week?
Depending on the week, we are. Some weeks, yes. Some weeks, we have all the space anyone could ever want. So it just depends on the week.
I was under the impression that we actually rented some of our community spaces for, I'll call it a nominal fee, $25, $50, $100, not on a Saturday. So you're saying we don't charge any rent for any of the rooms?
It depends what category they fall in. So if it's a resident or nonprofit that's in San Leandro, then no during the week. If it's non-resident, then we would charge during the week as well.
So I'm thinking about ways where we could find scale. And that scale would be, hey, we're opening this space for 2 hours for an organization that wants to rent it. We already have someone there monitoring the space. We could also have the front door open for the community to use and be thinking a little bit more creatively that way. You're not getting direction from council. I'm just trying to brainstorm with you a little bit about how we might think about this.
So the challenge there is with the limited hours we would be able to be open. What the community has desired with that meeting room space has been the standard programming we do at the other facilities. So that would very much limit the ability to do like story times and children's programming in that space, which, and the meeting room space is not huge, but it's not terribly small. It's about 30 people could fit in that room, if memory serves. It's about, for perspective, it's about the same size as the trustees room at the main library.
And my recollection was that the design had it such that the room could be cut in half into two meeting spaces?
No, so it's you're close. The back wall is a retractable like glass wall that opens up onto the patio. So it kind of expands to a slightly larger space. However, that becomes a little harder to use because we've nixed the awning outside. So any hotter than this, it might be a little bit rough because it is a full exposure to the sun.
Okay. I'm sure that we'll have the opportunity to keep thinking about that. Yeah. If you had any comments or things you want to explore. Okay, so with that, we will close this item and move to our next item, which I believe is committee member comments. I don't know that we have any at this time. Seeing none, I will adjourn this meeting. And our time right now, for the record, is 5:07. Thank you to the public for coming.